Hey, it's Doug here. I want to jump in and give a little disclaimer because today we're talking about estate planning. And the disclaimer is this is not financial or legal advice. So consult your professionals out there. We make it clear throughout, but it's always good to hit it up front. So, you know, do your homework. Basically, this is just entertainment. And Sean and I had a great conversation. We dive into a lot of the details, so hopefully you'll gain some knowledge from this, and hopefully you'll be inspired to set some things up. And we encourage people to, you know, meet with your professionals if you can meet in person or somehow be introduced to a lawyer to help you set some things up. That could be great, but I also want to give you an option for something else. So Trust and Will is an option. It's an online tool, and you can make your estate plan and kind of make it simple for you. You can set up a trust, you can set up a will, and Mile High Fi is an affiliate. So if you do work with them, we would get a commission, which helps support the show. But obviously, you get great value out of it. They have the trust stuff, they have the will stuff. But if you find yourself on the other side and you've lost a family member or a friend, they could actually help you navigate the probate situation. So there are thousands of positive reviews over on Trustpilot, and Trust and Will has a 4.6 out of 5-star rating over there. So a lot of good customer feedback. If you don't have any trust or will or any portion of your estate plan set up, this could be a perfect first option, a first thing that you can get to probably today. So check out Trust and Will if you find yourself in that situation. Sean Mullaney is an advice-only flat fee financial planner. Sean writes the Plutus Award-winning blog, FiTaxGuy.com, on the intersection of tax and financial independence. He also has a personal finance YouTube channel and wrote Solo 401k, the Solopreneur's Retirement Account. He's been featured all over, including the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, and MarketWatch. He's been on a bunch of podcasts, including Mile High Fi, Choose FI, The Stacking Benjamins Show, and How to Money. Today, we're going to talk about estate planning and why it's so important. And we'll get into a couple other things, including how to approach estate planning and bring it up, because people get a little uncomfortable since we're talking about death. Also, thinking about financial security for children if something happens to the parents, and thinking about aging parents and their estate plan. So let's get to the show. All right, Sean, let's get into it. So estate planning is often thought as something that only the wealthy need, but really it's pretty important to think about this and for really everyone to have a plan and consider it. So why is it so important?
All right, Doug, well, thanks so much for having me. Looking forward to the conversation. You know, if we have loved ones, I think we need estate planning. And so it's more than just, okay, you know, I'm a multimillionaire and I've got, you know, these land holdings and this huge portfolio. And so I need some estate planning. People think about the estate tax, which is actually usually a secondary or tertiary concern, not a primary concern. What you want to be thinking about is what happens in the event of your death. By the way, we're all dying, right? So this is not a when or an if, but a when. But we also want to think about it if it happens in an untimely fashion, because that's a hectic situation, right? Even when we have people in their 80s and 90s dying, it's a somewhat hectic situation. But think about it, you know, if you pass and it's, you know, unexpected, you're going to have your loved ones are going to be faced with a very sudden crisis, and then there's going to be financial and other matters in their life. What if you have kids? Who's going to take care of the kids? Where are they going to live? You know, what happens to your assets? Are things going to be frozen? There's all these logistical things to be thinking about. And this is really one of those where a penny of prevention is worth a pound of cure, right? Most estate planning for most Americans does not need to be, you know, 5 and 6 figures worth of planning that's incredibly sophisticated, right? I'm not to say there's no sophistication here, but boy, this is not rocket science. We're not splitting atoms when we do basic estate planning to make sure our loved ones are taken care of in the event of our demise.
And before we started recording, you mentioned you were at a campfire recently and Amy shared her story. And Amy has been on the show. She's actually a friend here in Longmont. But can you hit some of the high points of Amy's story just so people can kind of understand?
Yeah. And, you know, Amy's story illustrates something about estate planning from a profile perspective. You know, recall I said, right, we don't have to have hundreds of millions of dollars to be doing estate planning. You know, you look at Amy and her husband, right? They had double income. They were, I believe, just retiring or just retired or something like that. But essentially, they had some income and they had no kids. So you say, oh boy, that's going to be an easy estate planning situation, right? Because they don't even have kids. And then sure enough, her husband died in an untimely manner. There was an accident situation. He was, I believe, in his 40s. She was in her 40s. So a very untimely thing. And you say, well, okay, they have some beneficiary designation forms, right? Aren't they going to be fine? Well, it turns out one of the really big beneficiary designation forms in her case, or in her husband's case, had not been filed. So there was no, the quantum was something like $250,000, something like that. I'm not exactly sure that the amounts involved, but it was a significant amount, but also not a, oh my goodness, he played in the NBA type amount. Not at all. All right. So there's no beneficiary designation on file. That's a mistake. But then you say, well, oh, but maybe there's a will. Well, there was no will. So there was two mistakes. And if either one of them had been properly handled, then she wouldn't have run into the problem that she ran into. She ran into this big problem under Colorado's law. She and her husband were Colorado residents. And there was some provision there that says, well, if you die without a will and without kids, even if you're married, your parents are entitled to a piece of your estate that's not otherwise governed by like a will or a beneficiary designation form. And this was a six-figure account that her deceased husband's parents now had legal rights to. And this created a big legal controversy. And eventually, she had to fork over a bunch of this account to her deceased husband's parents, who were elderly. And that was not what they had all planned for. And if they had done some relatively basic estate planning, that situation, the legal fees, the family strife that involved could have been avoided. And so that's why we're talking about estate planning, not because we're trying to avoid, you know, $10 million of estate tax on our multi-billion dollar fortune. No. I mean, that matters for those people out there who are billionaires. But what we're really trying to avoid is strife and having assets go to places we wouldn't have anticipated they go to with some basic blocking and tackling in the estate planning regard.
And I'll link up for the episode that we interviewed Amy, and actually within days after interviewing her, I mean, I knew of the story and I knew Amy. Basically, we got our will done. So I'll link up and people can use this as like inspiration to like do your fucking will, like get some stuff in place, even if it's not what you, it's not the ideal situation if you just have some basic pieces in place, which maybe that's a good place to go to here, Sean. So when people are thinking about this, you mentioned, you know, a couple of mistakes in Amy's case, maybe talk about beneficiary information, maybe basic will stuff, but like, where do people get started if they know they're behind the eight ball here?
Yeah. So I think where you start is there are four funnels. Right. So there are four funnels of like, okay, what happens if I die? How is my property disposed of? Right. Like literally everything I own. Right. And there's basically four funnels. The first funnel is joint titled property. So you and your spouse own a house, right? Your joint tenants or your tenants by the entirety, joint tenancy, whatever it is styled as. Generally speaking, that just goes to the surviving owner. Right. There's nothing that a will does with that. There's nothing that a trust or anything like that. So that's taken care of at the first spouse's death. At the second spouse's death, that doesn't exist anymore. We could talk about that later. So joint tenancy takes care of a bunch of things, but certainly not all things. All right. Well, what about your financial assets, your life insurance policies, retirement accounts? That's a big one for a lot of folks in the audience. If you look, it's like, hey, we got a primary residence and we've got financial assets, and that's most of it. Well, the financial assets are controlled by something called a beneficiary designation form. And that thing is so critical, Right. So the first thing I would do for a lot of the folks in the audience, if I was behind the eight ball on estate planning, is, hey, you know, Vanguard, Fidelity, Schwab, Workplace 401k, whatever it is, my bank account, go in there. Do you have beneficiary designation forms on file with the institution? Do you pull up the institution's website and says, okay, here's the primary beneficiary, here's the secondary beneficiary? If you don't, you probably better take steps there. The good thing is, at least initially, you don't need a lawyer to do that, right? You know, say you have a 401k account at work and you're just like, oh yeah, look at that. I put the beneficiary designation form as my parents 10 years ago, but I got married 5 years ago. Good idea to update it to your spouse now in most cases, right? Or an old IRA or Roth IRA or brokerage account. Oh, I have an old girlfriend on that thing, right? No. Make sure you update it to, if it's your spouse, whoever you want to be the primary beneficiary. So second funnel is beneficiary designation forms. Third funnel is something called a revocable living trust. And we often use that for primary residences. So, you know, you could be living in Colorado. Your house could easily be worth $500,000, right? It doesn't have to be that luxurious to be $500,000. If you were to die and it's not jointly titled, or, you know, what if you both die? What if husband and wife die, right? Then you got a problem because that house is now going to be subject to what they call probate. Probate is a judicial process after one's death. And it's a way of spending a lot of money after your death and having complexity in terms of passing assets. We don't generally have beneficiary designation forms for houses. Some states are actually starting to tinker with that, but for the most part, we don't. So a lot of times the planning is simple. Put the house in something called a revocable living trust. You got to work with a lawyer on that, right? Unfortunately, we're now getting into a little more sophistication, although not a ton. But the idea would be you pass. Your house doesn't have to get probated through the courts of your state. What happens is you have a private instrument, a revocable living trust that on your death becomes irrevocable, and it just operates to pass the house to whoever passes the house. It stays out of the courts. It's not a public proceeding. This is basically what you're doing is you're paying the lawyer up front less money than you probably have to pay for probate after your death. So we like that. And it's just a private arrangement. So that's the third funnel, trusts. And they're not that sophisticated. It's not about tax saving or anything like that. None of that changes, right? We're not reducing our mortgage payment. We're not reducing our property taxes. We're still paying all that. This is literally to take care of it in the way we want it taken care of at our death. And then the fourth funnel is the will. And our hope is that we've passed almost all of it through the first three funnels, right? Because wills are great and we need wills, right? Wills are very important, but we want them to be, for those of you who watch football, they're like the safety on the defense, right? We're hoping the defensive line and the linebackers get the opposing players in the backfield or around the line of scrimmage. But every now and then a wide receiver breaks one for 20 yards. You want that to be 20 yards, not 80 yards to the end zone, right? And so the will is the safety. So what we're trying to do is let's not have anything go through that will. But if something winds up going through the will, then at least we got it in place. And so now we're at least steering the car in the probate process versus the laws of the state. We don't want the laws of the state, generally speaking. We want to be driving the car even after our death. The will is vital for doing that. But hopefully between beneficiary designation forms and revocable living trusts, we've sort of stripped our estate of everything that's going through the will. And our will hopefully wouldn't have to be probated because all that's going to be left is some clothing and a little bit of furniture. And as a practical matter, that generally doesn't get probated. So those are the four funnels. And I think you need to be thinking about, where are my beneficiary designation forms today? Are they completed? Are they out of date? And then, hey, you know what? What's my situation? Should I go talk to a lawyer? And maybe I need a revocable living trust. Maybe I need a will. Maybe I need both.
Couple notes and then follow-up questions. So people should double-check the beneficiaries periodically because at one point, some financial system, I don't remember what company it was, they updated things and it wiped out my beneficiaries that were in there, because I know I had filled them out before. So I don't know. Do you have a recommendation, Sean?
Yeah, so quarterly, a couple of things on that. I would occasionally audit beneficiary designation forms. So literally that is, hey, we all go into our accounts from time to time. And, you know, in the financial independence community, we sort of know like, hey, don't be checking your account every day. And that's good advice for the most part. But at the same time, you don't want to never check your account either. So especially on those bigger accounts, once a year, just go in there. You know, did I hit the last submit on, maybe I thought I completed my beneficiary designation and I didn't hit the last submit button or something like that. And I didn't, right? Just audit those things online. It's usually not that difficult at all. 2024 is a real life example of that. The Vanguard to Ascensus solo 401k transition. This is like a current event in the FI world this year. Vanguard said, we're getting out of the solo 401k business and we're sending all those solo 401ks to a firm called Ascensus. Well, okay, fine, right? That is what it is. We could debate. That's a different conversation for a different day. One thing that didn't come over with the Vanguard to Ascensus transition is beneficiaries. So if you're listening to this in the fall of 2024 and you're a new Ascensus solo 401k owner because you used to be at Vanguard, you may not have a beneficiary designation form on file right now. And so you probably want to, you know, maybe hit pause on this podcast. I know, Doug, that's verboten for me to say, but I'm going to say it anyway. Maybe hit pause on the podcast for just right now. Log into your Ascensus account and make sure you've got a beneficiary on file with respect to your Ascensus solo 401k.
Perfect. I literally have an Ascensus 401k from that transition. So yeah, I had to go set it up and check a couple of things out. So good point. The other portion is a clarification. So the revocable living trust is good for real estate. And I want to understand and make sure I'm not confused. So like this house, we'll just use me as the example. So this house, it's in my name and my wife's name. So if I were to die, then it would just, she would assume it. And then she's like the primary owner. But the revocable living trust would be important if we both died. Is that correct?
Yeah. So Doug, that's a great question. And I'm going to give you some strategic educational information on this one. I'm not a lawyer. I'm not a Colorado lawyer. But what I can say is you mentioned, well, what if we both die? And the thing is, you are both going to die, right? So yeah, generally speaking, what happens is, you know, most married couples these days probably have, I don't know the stats on this, but if I gun to my head, I would say probably most married couples have their house as either something called tenancy by the entirety or joint tenants with rights of survivorship. Either way, if only one of them dies, all right, the house just goes to the survivor. Somebody's probably going to have to go to the county courthouse to, you know, retitle the deed with them or whatever, because, you know, it's one person said to, but, you know, that's a ministerial task, annoyance, but no big deal. Okay. So where do you go from there? Where you go from there is, well, what if you're either a single person, you're divorced, you're a widow, widower, whatever it is, and then you own this house, right? What's going to happen to the house on your death? And now, whether you have, if you have a will and just in your own name, you either have a will and it goes through the will, which is fine, but this probate process, right? Which we try to avoid if possible. Why do we try to avoid it, right? Probate is not something to be feared, but it's something to be managed around if we can. Why do I say that? One is privacy, right? Not a huge concern for some people in the audience, but for maybe for some, it is a big concern. Probate proceedings or judicial proceedings are generally at least somewhat available to the public. So we don't want our familial laundry going through the public, but okay, fine. But then the second thing is just cost and complexity, right? You're going to have, you know, your loved ones are going to have to work with the courts in the state of your residence. And by the way, maybe your loved ones are adult children who live five states away. And so now they're going to have to come into your home state, deal with a lawyer in your home state. That's going to be annoying and it's going to cost money. So you say, well, what's the work around that? Well, the work around that in most cases, and this varies state to state, right? So that's one thing about having this conversation is most of the listeners are residents of 50 different states in the District of Columbia. So this does vary state to state. But what I've seen from a strategic perspective in most states, the work around is something called a revocable living trust, where at your death, the owner of the house isn't you, it's the revocable trust. Well, the revocable trust didn't die. And in fact, what the revocable trust did on your death is generally become irrevocable. It's not that big a deal if the only thing it owns is a house. But anyway, so the trust handles the disposition of the house to your next generation or to whoever your beneficiaries are. And the trust either holds the house, sells the house, whatever, you know, you work with your lawyer to say, okay, on my death, I want the house sold, or I want it held for this child, or whatever it is. Like, you know, you do you on that. But the trust keeps it out of this probate process, which A, provides more privacy, and B, minimizes what I sometimes refer to as friction, right? Legal hassle going through the probate process, legal costs of going through the probate process, that sort of thing. So look, it's, you know, very few things in this life I say are must-dos. And I would say this is not necessarily a must-do, but there are going to be a lot of folks out there who say, oh, I like that idea of avoiding probate, of keeping my arrangements private, that sort of thing.
All right. Perfect. So do you have any tips? Well, the thing is, like, this estate planning, we're talking about death, right? We're talking about death. So it makes people a little uncomfortable. Do you have any tips for families to bring this up and like have the discussions that they need to have to get started setting things up?
Yeah, I think it starts, you know, if you're married, it's talking with your spouse. And it's a couple of things. One is having a balance sheet. Right. So the balance sheet is an accounting term. I shouldn't use a technical term, but literally that's just a tally of all your assets and liabilities, which is a good thing to know in terms of your financial independence journey, regardless of your death. But what it does is, okay, if we have a balance sheet of everything we own, okay, if one of us were to die, we at least have, okay, this is what they owned. I can start going through these financial institutions and getting this all sorted out after their death. So that's one way to start the conversation. The second thing is, I mean, just think about your loved ones, right? A lot of times from an estate planning perspective, we think about our assets, and that's important, obviously. But I would think more about your loved ones, right? Who are your beneficiaries? And I've seen, you know, I'm a financial planner and I work with different types of people. I've seen, you know, the gamut, right? Minor children, elderly parents. Maybe it's elderly parents and siblings in another country, right? That adds a whole other layer of complexity to it. You know, you want to think more. I think sometimes this exercise overfocuses on assets and underprioritizes beneficiaries. Who are the people who are going to be handling this? And what's going to be easiest for them in terms of their, you know, in terms of them handling this? And is this somebody, oh yeah, my, you know, I'm single, and my younger sister who lives three states over and has no legal or financial sophistication is going to be inheriting this. Okay, that is what it is. And you're not going to be able to get her legally sophisticated or financially sophisticated overnight or anything like that. But, you know, what are those arrangements you could put in place now that would make this as easy as possible for her to inherit? And look, if it's a taxable brokerage account and you name her the 100% primary beneficiary, that's probably going to be good enough, right? I mean, that doesn't require that much sophistication. But what if she's going to have to come into this state and take over my house, right? I mean, she's going to have to do something, even if she just wants to sell my house, that's fine. But what's going to be the easiest for her to be able to navigate it? Is it going to be a probate process through the courts in my home state? Probably not, right? A revocable trust probably is going to be easier, but that's also a conversation to have with a lawyer. And, you know, you say, I mean, so one of the gating things you're going to hear, Doug, is, well, I don't want to work with a lawyer. Well, here's the thing. Lawyers are going to get their cut eventually, right? They're either going to get their cut doing some estate planning, will, revocable trust, that sort of thing, up front, and then a little administrative stuff on the back end in that arrangement, or they're going to get engaged on the back end entirely, and it's going to be probate time, it's going to be unraveling assets time. And, you know, my thesis is the lawyers are going to get a much lower cut if we work with them up front, right? I get we're going to have to cut a check up front, and nobody wants to cut a check. I get that. But I would rather cut a much smaller check up front and then a small check on the back end for some administrative work on the back end at your death versus, okay, now we have stress. We have multiple beneficiaries in the picture. We have probate in the picture. Guess what? You know, the lawyers, you know, they're going to get a much bigger cut, in my opinion, if there's no estate plan in process. I mean, just think about Amy's case, right? Where it was sort of a simple situation, but the lawyers got a nice cut because there was some gaps in the estate plan. Those gaps could have been taken care of on the front end. And now there's a lot less probability of paying those lawyers on the back end. So that's my whole thing is I would rather pay the lawyer less up front so they get less on the back end, a lot less on the back end potentially.
And while it's a little bit of a hassle to do that ahead of time, like if you're planning it, like you could architect like what you want to happen more specifically.
Yes.
And to your point, like you could make it easier on, you know, your family or other survivors or whoever else has to deal with this on the back end, which, like you said, it's complicated and they're walking into it potentially not knowing anything about any part of this process. So if we think about it ahead of time, it makes it easier for everyone. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And Doug, you know, one thing we haven't touched on, if you don't mind, is kids, right? So, because I feel a little remiss on this, I'd say two things about kids, at least to start the conversation. One is if you have minor children, you got to have an estate plan, right? That's where I sort of draw, you know, that's almost one of those must, you know, do because of something called guardians, right? What happens if both parents die? Your kids need guardians and you want to be intentional around that. And you don't want that going through the court system because the judge is, you know, judge may not honor what you would have wanted, right? So the easiest way, in most states, it's a will, right? You got to talk to a lawyer in your state. But naming a guardian and successor guardians, backup guardians, you know, things happen. So you definitely want backups named too. It's not that difficult at all up front. So that's the first thing. And then what about kids when you're going to be elderly, right? So eventually you're going to be elderly and your kids will be middle-aged and they may not live in your same state. And even if they do, you're going to want to think about some things around making things easier for them. And now different families are different ways in terms of, oh, mom and dad are worth $5 million. And do we reveal that to the kids? And that's sort of a decision you have to make separate from the estate planning side. But one thing I will say is you want to play it out in terms of your own death, which is eventually going to happen. And, you know, one little thing I think the FI community should focus a little more on, although I think there is some focus on this, is, you know, if you guys in retirement take a first class flight and it's, you know, $6,000 each, you know, round trip or something like that. Well, all right, that's a high expense, but there's no decision for your loved ones to be made after your death because of that. But if you start filling up the house with the tchotchkes, with this different stuff, you're now making your demise that much more taxing on your loved ones because they're going to have to go through all that. All the stuff is a delayed decision. You or more likely your loved ones are going to have to figure out what the heck do we do with this? Do we throw it out? Do we recycle it? Are there special disposition laws? Can we donate this? It becomes a hassle. So I think in terms of your future, you know, you want to spend a little bit on upgrading the hotel. Well, that's not a delayed decision for your kids when you die. But, you know, you get some bobblehead dolls in the house and all of a sudden your kids have all these delayed decisions that they have to make after your death. It makes it that much harder. So those are like two points I'd make about kids. You know, why not focus on, you know, one, we got to get the guardians in place if we have minor kids. And then two, maybe we arrange our affairs so that there's fewer decisions for our kids to make once we pass.
That's great. I haven't heard that discussed, but it kind of goes along with a mindset of like minimalism or just being like very aware and deliberate about, you know, the stuff that we're getting. So yeah, that's a great conversation. I have not heard many people bring that up. All right. So one follow-up on the guardian, do you have any tips on like how to navigate choosing a guardian? It sounds, that's kind of a big deal, right?
Yeah. And this is the sort of thing you definitely want to have conversations with the people you name as a guardian. Yeah. I mean, I think it's a lot of things. It's values. There's probably religion. You know, you probably want somebody who has the same religion that you and your family have. And there's a lot of things to be thinking about there. So I think it's values, religion. The other thing you want to think about is what's literally going to be the experience after your death with the guardian. So here's what I mean by that. Maybe you name an older sibling and their spouse is the guardian. And the older sibling has a house that's 2 times the size of your house. Okay. So your house, they wouldn't need your house to raise your kids. Okay. So you probably say, okay, we set up the house in a revocable living trust and then we sell it for the benefit of our kids, right? Something like that. But maybe the guardian is a younger sibling who's single and lives in a studio apartment and now would need your house to raise your kids. So you work with the lawyer to set up the trust so that the house can remain with the kids and the guardian so that the guardian can raise the kids in the house. Do you see what I'm saying? So mm-hmm. I think you want to be thinking about it that way too. You definitely want to ask, you know, permission to put somebody as a guardian, right? Because you don't want a situation where people are like, oh, I'm the guardian. What's going on there? And then they don't want to do it, or they've got doubts, or they're not mentally ready for it. And then the other thing is I generally recommend naming successor guardians, because even if they agree to do it during your lifetime, they're like, oh, yeah, I'll be your kid's guardian if you were to pass. Then it happens. Well, 2 things could have happened. One, they could have predeceased you. That's a possibility. And 2, they can change their mind, right? They're not legally compelled to be the guardian. And if they have changed their mind, you wouldn't want them to be legally compelled to be the guardian, right? So you probably want to think about some successor guardians and having that conversation as well. So, I mean, you want to think about geography, right? Do you want, you know, if you have maybe 2 siblings, one lives 20 miles from you, one lives 3 time zones from you, that may be a case for naming the one, you know, 20 minutes away, not because of any particular attributes other than, hey, they're close. My kids wouldn't have to move 3 time zones, that sort of thing. So yeah, lots of considerations there.
This episode is brought to you in part by Ghostbed. We just got a Ghostbed Luxe and I really like it. Now, I've usually only purchase mattresses like from the mattress store. So you get to lay down and roll around and see how it feels. So I was a little nervous to order one without testing it out first. But the cool part is with Ghostbed, you have a 101-night at-home sleep trial. So you're able to really test out the mattress and see how you like it. Now, we chose the Luxe because we were able to test out Carl's classic mattress, which is a little firmer, and we wanted something a little bit softer, and the Luxe fit the bill. So kind of perfect, but if you're unsure, they have a 2-minute or 3-minute quiz that you could take, and they could point you in the right direction. They have several different mattresses, and they do have cooling technology, which is super important to me. And the Luxe actually has sort of the coolest rating. There's some other mattresses that have a very cool rating as well, but it has this cool to the touch quilted cover. So it actually feels a little like colder when you touch it. Again, so important for me, summer, winter, it doesn't matter. I'm always hot in a cold, cooler mattress just works out better for me. So thanks a lot to Ghostbed. Do check out what they have to offer. They don't just have mattresses. They have bed sets, frames. They have sheets, pillows, anything that can help you sleep. You can save 50% with a coupon code MILEHIFI. And you could also go to ghostbed.com/MILEHIFI to save 50% site-wide. So thanks a lot to Ghostbed. Thinking about a role of like working with a financial planner, like my mm-hmm. wife and I started working with a planner just to have another set of eyes and help us, you know, communicate more effectively. And then we're talking about working with another professional, a lawyer, potentially to set things up. Where do the lines end up? Like if you're working yep. with a client and you're like, here, we need to set up this stuff. You guys agree on it. And then how does it hand it off to the law experts?
Yeah, so great question. And what I tell clients is you can do financial planning and estate planning with a lawyer sort of in parallel, right, at the same time. And so what a financial planner can do, assuming he or she is not a lawyer, right, so they can't write a will or write a trust or provide a legal opinion that under state X's law, this is the outcome of whatever it might be, right? So they can't do that. But a financial planner can provide strategic and tax advice in the estate planning realm. So what that means is they can come into your situation and say, oh, I see you don't have beneficiary designation forms on file with respect to your 401k. I think you should file a beneficiary designation form, right? They can say something like that. Or they can say, you know, you don't have a will and you happen to have three minor kids and all these assets, I'd probably go ahead and work with a lawyer and get a will in place, right? They can say that, right? But they can't write their trust. They can't write the will, you know, so they can provide what I refer to as sort of strategic and tactical recommendations around, hey, these are arrangements. If I were you, I would have in place. And now, yeah, go talk to a lawyer to get them in place. And, you know, the lawyer can do all of that, right? The lawyer could provide strategic advice, legal advice. They can write the will. They can write the trust. And the financial planner and the lawyer can talk to each other, right? That you can authorize your different advisors to talk to each other about this stuff. And you could, you know, say, hey, I want to be part of that conversation too, which I think is a good thing as well. So yeah, there's definitely possibilities of working, I think there are people out there thinking, oh, should I get a financial planner? Should I get an estate lawyer? The answer might be both. You know, some people may just have a great DIY financial plan in place, but they've got issues on the estate side. Maybe they only need a lawyer. Now, if you need a will or a trust, then you're going to, so we could talk about DIY options on that, but I generally recommend going to a lawyer if you need a will or a trust.
Okay. Let's put a pin in that and come back to it because I'm all over the place here, but I want to talk about taxes because you mentioned it a minute ago, I think. So those, because you're a CPA as well, right?
Yeah, I'm a financial planner and I am licensed as a CPA.
Okay.
And part of financial planning is tax planning. So absolutely. And Doug, you're absolutely right. I'm not exactly sure where you're going with this, but you're absolutely right to be thinking that tax should be a consideration in our estate planning, regardless of the level of our wealth. And for most people out there, it's not really the estate tax they want to be thinking about in their estate planning. It's the income tax on it, but we can talk about that more. So yeah, go ahead with the question.
Nope, you nailed it. It was just a general, like, what do we need to be concerned with and how can we set things up to be as efficient as we want to be and can be?
Yes. So the biggest hurdle for most people, the estate tax is out there in the zeitgeist, right? But truth be told, it's paid by, I believe it's less than 1% of Americans, right? So what you want to be thinking about mostly, although there are going to be some people in the audience who probably do want to be doing some estate tax planning, but most of it's income tax planning. So what I mean by that is it's a few things. One, on the retirement accounts, the odds are the best tax play is going to be leave it to the spouse. Now, there are some options of leaving some of those not to a spouse. Generally, workplace plans, you pretty much have to leave to a spouse unless they sign that away. But IRAs in theory could, there's at least some portion of the IRA or Roth IRA that could go to somebody other than the spouse. From a tax perspective, you generally want it to go to the spouse because they have the most favorable inheriting rules. Okay. But beyond, second generation, beyond spouses, you want to think about some nickel dime things. Like, for example, maybe at your death, you want to leave $50,000 to your church. Okay. Well, that's great. Maybe that should go through a traditional IRA, not through a taxable brokerage or through a Roth IRA. Why? The traditional IRA has income tax associated with it in the future, but guess what? Churches don't pay that tax. So wouldn't it be great to carve off $50,000 into what I refer to as a church IRA? I did a blog post on this topic. And have the church be the beneficiary of that. They don't pay income tax. You've just cut $50,000 out of the income tax system. That's great. So that's one consideration. Another consideration is, I have a taxable brokerage account and I have an IRA and I have two kids. One of them is a teacher and one of them is an executive at a Fortune 500. Well, you might want to leave the teacher the traditional IRA because they might pay very little tax on it versus the executive at the Fortune 500 who might pay a lot of tax because it just gets, piled on the top of their income. They pay tax at, maybe 37% on that versus the teacher might only pay tax at 22% on that, right? So there's little things you could do there. I think a lot of it has to do with the charitable piece of it. And then also, if you're going to leave a retirement account to somebody other than a spouse, you want to think long and hard before you do that, very long and hard. And just one of the many reasons for that is you're probably sacrificing some tax benefits.
Okay. Yeah, I never thought of that, especially, the examples you gave are perfect. Before I probe further into that. The estate tax, what level is that? Very few people have that much money, right?
Yeah. So it's a couple of things, right? So in theory, there's this asset-based tax at death, but we have exemptions. And the exemptions right now are scheduled to come back down to the $7 to $8 million range per person, you know, in the year 2026. I actually doubt that's going to happen, or it's going to happen to that degree. Right now in 2024, the exemption is something like $13.91 million per person. So you got to be pretty wealthy, even in the FI community, to die with $13.91 million to your name, right? You got to be real wealthy for that to happen. But even if the exemption comes back down to, say, $7 million per person, for married couples, there's a real easy workaround. It's called portability. All this is, right, so think about husband and wife. They each have a $7 million exemption, right? Let's just say they don't increase the exemption starting in 2026, it goes down. Let's just say that for argument's sake. Okay, well, $7 million, and then one of them dies and leaves whatever they've got to the surviving spouse. Well, you can leave $1 billion to a surviving spouse. There's no estate tax at that point. Once you leave it to the kids, then you have estate tax. But you can leave $1 billion to your wife or to your husband, whoever it is, as long as they're your spouse, no estate tax. So a common technique now is they call it portability. All it is at the first spouse's death, they file a Form 706. It's an estate tax return with the IRS. It's not about paying estate tax. It's about preserving the exemption, that $7 million in my example. That gets glommed on to the surviving spouse. Now they have $14 million, not $7 million, when they die. And so there's going to be a big swath of Americans who avoid the estate tax just through this thing called portability. You got to talk to your lawyer about it, because you have to file a Form 706. That's going to be a low four-figure exercise in most cases, but it can buy, you know, millions of dollars of estate tax exemption. So even with between just the high exemption now and this thing called portability for married couples, very few people, even in the FI world, are ever going to sniff paying estate tax. Now, there are some states, mostly northern states for whatever reason, that have a small estate tax. Those things tend to be nuisances more than huge primary, you know, it's like this little nuisance tax that your kids will have to pay. Those tend to also have their own high exemptions. There's some states where the exemption isn't that high, but they tend to be more annoyances, because the federal estate tax rates are like 35, 40, 45%, something like that. The estate tax rates are much lower. So in particular states, you may want to talk to your estate lawyer about that. But for the most part, estate taxes are not going to be that big a thing for most people, even in the FI community.
Okay. So the one other follow-up. So you're pretty smart, Sean, that's why I asked you here. The thought process that you laid out before for minimizing the taxes by leaving certain accounts to maybe someone who doesn't pay as much taxes, or if you're donating to your church, do you think you're more advanced than other CFPs out there? Because there's a lot of range.
Yeah, yeah. And just a quick clarification. Yeah. So I'm a financial planner. I actually am not a quote-unquote CFP. I am a financial planner. I'm a CPA. So there's all these letters going out there. I'm a CPA. Okay. I'm not a CFP. It's all good.
Sorry. Okay.
I think different financial professionals have different levels of sophistication and different levels of interest on different things. So it never hurt for a client to raise an issue with their financial professional. And, you know, clients raise issues with me. And, you know, sometimes, like, you know, two heads are usually going to be better than one. So if you have particular concerns, I would say, look, go talk to your financial professional and say, hey, you know, I was thinking about X, Y, and Z. And you can even send, hey, you know, and this even came across my radar. You can go, like, you know, for example, on my blog, I'll toot my own horn here. I have a blog post called The Church IRA, because I think this is a really nifty little tactic on passing wealth to a charity and cutting the IRS out as much as possible. And it's a very legal tactic. You know, it's literally just a choice you make. I mean, your kids lose out on some money, would have been taxable to them. I make an argument, it would have been taxable to them at their highest rate. So it's like the best money to cut out from your kids. But, you know, I think it's that sometimes we just, you know, we all got a million different things going on. This is the fall of 2024. You know, I happen to be a Mets fan and a Jets fan. I mean, this past week has been just replete with news and games. And, you know, so we all have millions of different things going on. You know, so it doesn't hurt to focus your financial professional or your lawyer's attention on something. Right. And say, hey, you know, this has been on my mind. And you can even say, oh, yeah, and this piece of content stumbled, you know, came across my radar. Does this have any applicability to me? So that's sort of how I would approach that. You know, yeah, different people just have different interests and may just have different things on their mind. And so different planners sort of emphasize different things. That doesn't make one planner right and the other planner wrong. It just means that we all have natural areas of focus and interest. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't hurt to step back when you're working with your professional and say, hey, what about X? What about Y? I've done a little reading on it. I'm just curious your take, yada, yada.
Got it. So diplomatic. that's a good answer. Okay. As we're wrapping up, Sean, there are, you know, we talked about, I guess, like the whole life cycle, a lot about death. This is all about death.
Yep.
Many of us have aging parents. Do you have any tips on bringing up the conversation? It can be uncomfortable, like money and it's death. But if we're unsure, like, you know, we're trying to set things up for our own heirs, and it's like we may be on the receiving end. So how can we grease the wheels a little bit?
Yeah. So and Doug, I think this is a very challenging issue, right? Because, you know, your parents are not compelled to disclose their finances to you. And in fact, right, you got to look at the laws of each different state, but the general legal principle is your parents can disinherit you, right? They don't have a legal obligation to leave you their IRA or their primary residence or whatever it might be. So that could be a challenge as well. Couple things. One, the first death is an opportunity to have some of those conversations because it just naturally brings those things to mind. And there'll be, generally speaking, at the first death, now, it depends on how old the parent is, right? So if the parent, the surviving parents in their 50s or 60s, they may not need your help to sort of resolve the first parent's estate. But maybe, you know, the surviving parent is in their later 70s, 80s, 90s. They may be bringing you in just because they don't have the mental bandwidth to handle the processing of the first estate. So that can be an opportunity like, oh, while we're doing this about dad's estate, mom, where are your assets? Like that sort of thing, right? And that can help a little bit. That can absolutely help, you know. But the other thing is, most of us have at least some idea about our parents' situation. So what I mean by that is not that we know the dollars and cents of like to the penny. Oh, my, you know, my parents showed $100,000 in their tax return, and they have $2.7 million of assets. Most of us don't know that. Maybe we do, right? Maybe our parents are much older and we're involved because, you know, they don't have the mental capacity. But you probably know, oh yeah, my parents have 5 rental properties in Arkansas and they live in Colorado. You know, I might want to just ask them about that just to say, hey, mom and dad, have you made estate planning arrangements on that? Not even for me necessarily, because if they haven't, that's going to be a tremendous hassle. It's called out-of-state real estate, right? So I sometimes joke that you don't want to die with out-of-state real estate in your name because that means probably 2 probate processes. So that very much argues for a trust type arrangement. But so maybe if you know that your parents have some oddities in their financial life, out-of-state real estate, farmland, a small business, right? You know, you could broach that conversation not so much with how much am I getting, mom and dad, more with, hey, have you talked to your lawyer, mom and dad, about that small business stock you own? Or, you know, that syndicate interest you own, or, you know, or the 5 rental properties you own in, you know, Alabama or whatever it might be. And so maybe you do it that way. But I will say, Doug, this is definitely a challenging issue. And, you know, you do want to think about, you know, all right, what's going to happen if my parents die, and just how messy or not messy is this going to be?
Sean, is there anything that I forgot to ask about or that you think is important we discuss here as well?
No, I think sometimes in the FI community, we're attracted to the shiny objects. And by the way, that's not necessarily a bad thing, right? Oh, the backdoor Roth IRA. Well, you can learn a whole lot about your own finances by focusing on something like the backdoor Roth IRA. And that's great. And why not go down a rabbit hole and have some fun with that? But if you got three kids under 18 at home and you don't have a will and you're focused on the backdoor Roth IRA, I think you've missed the forest for the trees, right? You know, in terms of lived experience and what really matters, getting a will in place, particularly when we have minor children, is going to matter a whole lot more than a backdoor Roth IRA. So I think just keeping that in mind and saying, and the other thing too is no shame, right? Like, we weren't born with estate plans, although technically we were because of the laws of the state where we live. But we're not born with a will and a trust and beneficiary designation forms. There's no shame in being like, yeah, you know what? I'm really behind the ball on that one. Take some time, get in front of it, and just take some positive action to get a little bit better on that. And sometimes that does require calling up a lawyer, and that is what it is.
All right. Well, Sean, this has been very educational. I hope we inspired people to take some action on this. And we'll link up to some of the shows I mentioned before, the article that you mentioned. And, you know, where can people find you, Sean?
Yeah. So, Doug, thanks so much. Really enjoyed this conversation. You can find me on my blog, fitaxguy.com. You can find me at my financial planning site or firm, mulaneyfinancial.com. And then on YouTube, just type in Sean Mulaney videos into the search bar and you'll get my YouTube channel.
All right. Awesome. Well, this has been a pleasure and thanks a lot.
All right. Thank you, Doug. Really enjoyed the conversation.
Thanks for listening to the show. That was the Mile High Five podcast, and I'm Doug Cunnington. If you dig the show, please do three things for us. Number one, tell a friend, a family member, an enemy about the show. We really don't care who you tell. Maybe forward them a specific show that you know that they will like. It's the single most helpful thing that you can do to spread the word. It's like giving us a virtual high five, and actually we don't give high fives in person, so the virtual kind's pretty good. And more importantly, your friend or family member or even your enemy will appreciate the fact that you were thinking of them. Number two, make sure you're following or subscribed on your podcast app, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Overcast, YouTube, whatever you're using, and that way you won't miss a show. And number three, please leave us a rating and review. We read them on the show occasionally, and you might hear yours out there on an upcoming episode. Quick disclaimer. This show is not financial or legal advice. I'd actually be surprised if it sounded like it. It's really just for entertainment, and that's at least what we're hoping for. But seriously, get advice from professionals. So we'll catch y'all next week. So what renovations are you having at your home, if you're able to talk about that?
Yeah, we had a whole bunch of stuff. So a lot of new lighting. So we have a toddler goddaughter who visits frequently, and you know she's starting to run around now, right? So all the railings on the stairs were not up to code, you know, because the townhouse comes from the 1970s. So we got those all improved, a bunch of painting, new countertops. Oh yeah, a whole lot of miscellaneous things. The townhouse we live in, you know, dates back to the 1970s, and it was just sort of up for a new floor, a lot of new flooring. We had an issue in the kitchen with that anyway. So a whole bunch of like a lot of different mishmashes. We didn't extend it. We live in a townhouse, right? So there's no extension or addition or anything like that, but a whole bunch of stuff.
Gotcha. How's the schedule going? I know usually it's always behind, but how's it going?
Yes.
For you?
It's definitely a little behind. I mean, fortunately, they originally said 1 month and it's become 2+ months, which from what I gather in the construction world, that's like to be expected, right? And thank goodness they didn't say 9 months because then it would be 18 months, right? Yeah. So, you know, that's okay. I'm not a big fan of construction projects, but that's me. But we will get through it. And yeah, it'll be in our past soon enough. And that's good.
Right. You know, to your point, it's like you know, there's people in there, there's a bit of a mess, they have to bring in materials and all that, and I'm in a unfinished basement. So it's great for a studio because like you could only see what you need to see. There's trash all over the floor, but you can't see that. We'd like to get it finished, although we don't like really need anything specific down here. So it's kind of hard to, you know, design something where we're like, well, we don't really need the space. Like I just have my stuff down here and then some light storage. But overall, the scary part is like having the contractors, having the schedule and knowing, you know, they're going to be carrying a bunch of stuff like down the stairs and like through the normal house and our dot. So anyway, it just sounds like
it's just, it's fun. Disruptive, right? It's definitely disruptive. And you know, we haven't had a big renovation project in a while. So that's good. Right. So it's sort of like we were on borrowed time anyway. So my hope is we'll get through this and then the disruptions will be much fewer and further between.